Everyone, welcome to Who's Training Who, Episode 6. I'm Tom.
I'm Allie.
This podcast is all about dogs. We talk training, behavior, give tips and tricks, talk to people who do cool things with dogs and or for dogs. We hope that by listening to this podcast, we can help you have a better relationship with your dog and any dog you meet. On today's episode, Allie and I talk about the different types of training methods. So let's get started. So Allie, now that we are all getting back into society slowly, lots of people have new dogs, whether they're puppies, new adoptions, or they purchased. I'm seeing countless posts on social media about needing a trainer. But as we know, not all trainers are the same. Different methods are used, from positive-based, balanced trainers, or aversive trainers. Even though I don't think any trainer would outright call themselves an aversive trainer, that would be a terrible marketing thing. So we'll talk about these three types of training methods in more details in this podcast. But first, let's talk about what should you look for in a trainer.
The training industry is extremely unregulated. So there are a lot of people that potentially just have a passion for dogs, and they've worked with their own dogs and have trained their own dogs to do tricks, or have trained their own dogs, you know, maybe some slight behavior modification, and because it worked for their dogs, they potentially think that they are now a skilled dog trainer. When we're looking for trainers, some important things to ask are, you know, what kind of continued education that they have. So do they do any kind of workshops or conferences? Do they do some self-study, reading books? Do they mentor with any other trainers? You can always, if you're taking a group class, you can certainly ask to observe a class. Generally, if you are not allowed to observe a trainer's methods, usually that's a bad sign. You know, it all comes down to your comfort level also. If you feel that this trainer hasn't answered your questions correctly, or, you know, if you're uncomfortable with the methods that they're using, certainly don't use them. Another red flag for me is if a trainer makes guarantees. Right on my contract, I say that I do not make behavior guarantees. The reason that I don't do this is I can't guarantee anyone's behavior. I can't guarantee any animal. I can't guarantee any person. You know, that is up to the individual in itself. But generally, you know, the things that I'm looking for, do they have credentials? There are a lot of different schools, you know, and they are not all created equally. But, you know, do your research on some of the letters behind their names and the ideas that school has. Obviously, I completely support reward-based training. You know, I am a positive reinforcement trainer, so if you can find a reward-based trainer that you're comfortable with, obviously that would be the route that I would recommend personally.
All right, so you brought up an interesting point of guarantees. I see that a lot in a lot of the trainers that I don't like, who claim in 2 weeks we can train your dog and it's a lifetime guarantee. And it always puzzled me until I went into one of these places and saw what they did. I then understood what they did and why they could say that. So that brings us into aversive training, because that's what a lot of these trainers do. They use shock collars. They use choke collars. They basically hurt your dog. I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. That's what they do. They're going to sugarcoat what they do to your dog. But in the end, they're hurting your dog one way or the other, whether it's, you know, I mean, I've seen trainers who, to get the dog to lay down, they step on the leash and make it shorter and shorter until the dog lays on the ground that way. And the dog is screaming in pain. And if you've never seen that in person, I hope you never do, because it really is terrible to hear that and to see that somebody thinks that's okay to do. But Allie, let's talk about what goes into aversive training. It's not all just shock collars. You know, there is food. There's food deprivation. There, you know, it's pinch collars, choke collars, all that. It's kind of anything that is what a good way to say it is. Anything that hurts your dog is considered an aversive training method.
Yeah, aversive like you said, there's a lot of different things that go into it. You know, prong collars and electric collars are typically what we see, but there are people out there that will withhold food to get your dog to perform. They will withhold water to get your dog to perform. Choke collars, you know, there's plenty of different types of things that certainly range.
So Allie, let me stop you there for a second. I want to make sure that everyone listening, if they don't understand, understands the difference between aversive trainers who deny food and reward-based trainers who they may say they don't feed their dog breakfast right in the morning. An aversive trainer will literally starve your dog throughout for until that dog complies and then maybe gives them a little food. A reward-based trainer maybe doesn't give your dog breakfast or dinner, but they will give the dog food as part of training. So, and so yes, they, you know, hey, we just won't feed our dog first thing in the morning, but in that time, they're going to do training with the dog's food that the dog is getting its meal. It's not being deprived of the meal as like an aversive trainer would.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, so just for example, when I was in Care and Prior Academy, we had to do our weekend workshops. My dog wouldn't get fed breakfast on that Saturday and Sunday because guess what? She was going to be eating treats all day long, especially because she is a high maintenance crater, which basically, you know, to keep her calm and happy in the crate, she has to get some reinforcement quite regularly. So I knew she was going to get more than she needed, you know, both Saturday and Sunday for those workshops. You know, same thing if I have a dog that, you know, the owner says they're not particularly food motivated. Well, if they're not particularly food motivated, I'd like to figure out why. You know, obviously it could be that they just don't enjoy their food that they're on or they're not working for it or whatever it is. But if I know that the dog is a little bit pickier, then I want a hungry dog if I'm going in for, you know, an hour and a half consult and I'd like to get the owners to be able to see things and get their dog to do things.
So now,
go ahead.
Do you believe that people who say that I have a dog that's not food motivated, are there dogs that are truly for no other reason, they're just not really interested in treats. They're not interested. I mean, I would assume all animals eat. So they're in the basis, they're food motivated, but maybe not necessarily treat motivated?
And this is kind of an interesting topic because dogs may not be food motivated, but that is not to say that they don't want to eat. But there are different reasons that we maybe haven't identified. So a lot of times when an owner tells me their dog doesn't really eat or they graze or whatever, well, part of that could be, yeah, you've let them graze for the last 3 years and that's why they graze. They're not finicky. They just have gotten, you know, that's what they're used to. So they know that they can go all day and get food. Another aspect of that is maybe they don't like their kibble for some reason. Another thing that I'm always recommending to owners, make your dog work for food. You know, if your dog was out and undomesticated, they would have to find their food and they would have to figure out how to earn it. So, you know, like we talked about in that enrichment segment, get your dog to do things for their food. And a lot of times that makes your dog more food motivated.
Except for my dog. I tried that after we had that I tried a snuffle mat and, you know, like you said, it's been years that he's never had to really try for his food. And then I did the snuffle mat for like a week. And every time he's like, he looks at it. He's
And some dogs just don't enjoy that. But if you introduce something else, potentially, they might. So for example, I mean, the dog I have here right now for boarding, he doesn't like the snuffle mat. But if I scatter food all over my living room floor, he eats it off there. So he's fine with that. But anyway, back to the food motivation. Right. Another thing is a lot of people are using store-bought treats that just aren't that high value for dogs. Usually if you switch to hot dogs or cheese or plain boiled chicken or just something human grade, your dog is going to work for it. And I always say, you know, people are always like, my dog is dumb. No, you probably just haven't found the right motivator for your dog. And it doesn't, you know, there are dogs that just really aren't that motivated by food, and that's okay for whatever reason, you know, and it could be something medical. Maybe they need their teeth done. You know, maybe they just don't feel good when, you know, we're training. Maybe they're anxious about training because they have had aversive training in the past and they're not sure what to expect. When I first got Hunk, he was not treat motivated to train at all. When I figured out that the ball was his number one motivator, that changed the game. And then once he figured out that reinforcements happen for behavior, he would start to take treats. And that changed the game again. So it's not necessarily that, you know, your dog is dumb. It's not necessarily that your dog is unfood motivated. It is that we just haven't figured out what drives their behavior yet.
That's interesting what you said about Hunk, that he isn't food motivated. You actually have experience with a dog that isn't, that wasn't necessarily food motivated when you first got him. How long did it take once you figured out that the ball was highly motivated to him taking treats? Or was it, did you understand that the ball was it right away? Or did it take time for you? Did you try different things before you found that the ball was what really motivated him?
I mean, I definitely was trying to use food first because food is easier, you know, especially when we're looking at toys as reinforcers. We have to find out what part of that toy is reinforcing. So, you know, like for example, with the ball, is it reinforcing that you get to run back and forth? Is it reinforcing that you get to chew on it for a while? Is it reinforcing, you know, that you get to run around in circles for a bit and then bring it back?
Wow, so I never really thought about
it. Yeah, food is a little bit easier.
Right.
You know, you hand it, they're happy. Great. Everybody's good. Toys, we have to find out what parts motivate them. But I also know, you know, about the certain dogs that I work with, the kind of levels of reinforcement. So like, a ball is Hunk's number one. And then I would say his second is cheese. And there's definitely different kinds of cheese that he will work harder for than others. For example, I just went and because I can't get like anything at the stores right now, I ordered off my delivery meal service thing or my weekly delivery box or whatever for produce. I ordered like this cheese that was this sharp cheddar for like $6 for like 6 ounces. And I was like, this is so expensive. These dogs better love this. Like, it's not going to last very long. And of course they loved it. I mean, loved it, loved it, loved it. But then I got out liver sausage for the first time ever. Excuse you. Got out liver sausage for the first time ever, which I paid $3 for like a pound for. And Hunk was just like, this is the best thing ever. So now I'm like, okay, so it's ball, now liver sausage, which is completely disgusting right. for me. And then cheese, and then, you know, some meats. And, you know, he definitely has his you know, this is what I'll work really, really hard for. And this is what I'll work for. And then this is what he will. And he will actually literally spit treats out if he's like, nah, wow. I'm good. I don't want to be reinforced for that behavior. Forget this treat.
I know we're getting kind of off topic for all this stuff, but you brought up the ball and the different ways, like, yeah, you brought up the way the ball, that it could be a bunch of different things with the toy. So what is it for Hunk that you figured out was the reward with the ball?
Hunk likes the run back and forth. Hunk is, I'm going to go get it. I'm going to bring it back. And then I'm going to get it and bring it back and get it back and get it back. Whereas my other dog, who's very ball motivated as well, hers is about stopping and chewing on it for a little bit. Okay. So if I don't allow her to stop and chew on it, she's just like, okay, I'm done with this game. I don't want to run back and forth a million times. That is not my game. My game is chomping on the ball for a few seconds and then bringing it.
All right, so let's get back into what we were talking about. We're getting more to the positive side, and we're going to get to that, but I want to ring back and talk about the other forms of training. So let's start with aversive, because that's our biggest X, cross, no-no training thing. But I think what I like about you as a trainer and, you know, why I wanted to do a podcast with you in the first place was that you're one who, and maybe other trainers who are reward-based do admit it, I just have not really heard them admit when they say that, you know what, aversive training, some of the techniques you use, they do work. They do work, but not for the reasons that reward-based training works. There's different mentality that goes into an aversive trainer and what happens to your dog. And so how about you explain what some of that is? So you're right, you could shock your dog and it can sit, but what compared to reward-based, what you're doing mentally to your dog is completely different.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not going to touch too much on aversive training methods just because I don't use them. I don't support them. I'm not going to pretend like I have all the knowledge about punishment because, again, I've never needed to research how to use a prong collar because I don't need to use that in my list of tools. But there are a lot of adverse effects that have been studied and proven that go along with using punishment-based training. It does suppress behavior. So yes, it does work. And yes, it is a quick fix. However, the risk is greater than the reward. And I'm sure in plenty of our podcasts, I've probably talked about risk versus reward in a lot of different situations. So for me personally, the behavior fallout that we experience and the aggression that is related to punishment-based training is just not worth it if we can use other tools first. I'll just briefly touch on LIMA protocol, LIMA. LIMA protocol is least intrusive, minimally aversive. So that basically means that we would want to use the least intrusive, minimally aversive methods first and then work our way towards other things. But I don't want to get too into that. We'll attach some of to the show notes, we'll attach a LIMA statement on there. But, you know, the way punishment works is that it has to be painful enough for the dog to want to stop the behavior. So part of the issue besides the behavior fallout that we may experience with our dogs is that we may have to cause more and more and more and more pain. And causing more and more and more pain, not only does it damage the psychological aspects of the dog, but it also can cause injury. It can cause severe, trauma to the neck, whether it be puncture wounds from a prong collar, burns from an electric collar because we just keep turning it up higher and higher because it's not working to suppress the behavior we were working to suppress. You know, it can cause... Yep. And unfortunately, that can happen with, you know, regular collar as well, which is why we recommend using harnesses. Because, again, if a dog pulls hard enough, they can damage their own trachea if they have a delicate trachea, which, you know, you're just not going to know until you get into it. But, you know, like I said, for me personally, you know, causing pain to a dog is not something I want to do. Breaking the bond between a dog and I is not something I want to do. You know, for me, learning theory is very simple. Reinforcement, whatever that is, toys, play, food, you know, whatever your dog is reinforced by, reinforcement drives behavior. Telling a dog what they did right drives behavior.
I think the issue, and, you know, we've talked about this, not on podcasts, just between ourselves, is, you know, trainers who use shock collars, who use the aversive stuff, they have great marketing compared to a rewards-based trainer. Because like you said, you don't have a guarantee, which, you know, first off, that somebody who like doesn't want to do the work with the dog, that's like, well, I don't want to do that because I want a guarantee, which is they get it. Oh, in 10 days, we're going to have your dog trained. Hey, you know, all you have to do is push this button or jerk the chain or do this. That's what the aversive trainers have. They have, it's easy for the consumer to do it. You don't have to do much. We do it all. And hey, there's a lifetime guarantee. Just bring them back and we'll reshock them. We'll redo, you know, whatever it is. And
well, let me stop you there. Okay. Something I learned very, very early on was that so many people are awful at timing with their clicker training.
Right.
So what do you think you do when you are not super proficient at timing and you shock your dog at the wrong time, or you jerk on that leash at the wrong time.
That's a great point.
You cause a lot of psychological damage, plus you're not suppressing the behavior that you mean to. So that leads me into suppressing those fear behaviors. So if your dog is displaying the growl or the crouching down and looking intense because they're afraid, if you start correcting that, guess what? You suppress that. So when your dog attacks out of nowhere, it's because they've been punished enough to not display those warning signs. We need those warning signs.
So I'm going to give you an example from my personal life with family members, and you can tell me if I'm wrong in my thinking or not. So they have two dogs in their household. One dog, when it goes to eat, freaks out that the other dog is, and they both growl at each other. The one that's eating has a high-pitched noise that's really irritating, and they both growl at each other. The other dog like sits far away and just sits there and stares and growls and growls. And so what do the parents do? Start yelling at one or the other. And so in my, I keep telling them over and over, you can't yell because you're, you know, the dog that's eating, that's squealing, he's already terrified. At least in my mind, I think he's scared that the other guy is going to come and steal his food. And, you know, if the dog gets close enough, they do fight, you know, about it. They get, you know, I mean, not like bloody fights, but just like, you know, growling and whatever. But, you know, I keep trying to tell her, stop yelling because you're I don't know if punishing the right word, but, you know, cause sometimes I just think dogs think yelling is just you barking too and just screaming and being loud too. But, you know, I keep trying to tell them like, you can't yell at the one that's eating the food and growling because you just have to be calm about it. You have to take the other dog away so that the fear is there. The dog, you know, the dog is either scared of that the food's going to be stolen or, you know, the dog's getting whatever the issue, you know, I don't totally know, but they yell at the dog every time I'm there. Every time I'm like, just stop yelling. You're making it worse when you're yelling at the dog because the dog's growling. And that's when they start yelling, like, just stop yelling. Like you have to take the situation away. That's a long story for what it is, but when you talk, that's what I think about is like, they're yelling at the dog. They're, you know, sometimes they, you know, they'll give a smack on the butt, which, you know, I know people do and it's, you know, it is what it is, you know, but I'm like, you got to stop because you're actually punishing the dog to a point. You're making it worse. You're making that dog more fearful that, oh, now I'm going to be yelled at when I do this. You know, it's kind of like if people do shock collars with dogs who jump when the door opens up or jumps on people or starts growling when the door opens. And like you said, with timing, you shock the dog at the wrong time. You could be telling that dog, oh no, every time that door opens, I get shocked. Something bad happens. So I'm going to go attack what's coming through that door. I don't even know what it is, but I'm going to attack it because every time that door opens, I get shocked or chain pulled or whatever technique you want. That's punishment. You're actually training the dog to fear that door is opening and that something bad always happens when somebody opens that door.
Well, and for your two dogs eating together and clearly not being comfortable about it.
Right.
Again, back to risk versus reward. Is there a reason that those two dogs need to eat in the same room? Can they not just be separated and eat comfortably? You're exerting more energy by yelling and making a big fuss out of it.
Oh,
when
I
you
totally
could
agree.
Just go set a bowl in one room and set a bowl in another room, you know, and as a trainer, that is what I would walk into a client's house and say, is there a reason that these two dogs need to eat together? Do not reinvent the wheel. This is a behavior that doesn't need to be fixed. This is a natural behavior for a dog to guard its food against another dog.
Right.
Don't, you know, what is the reward of having the two dogs eating next to each other? And unfortunately, in our industry, there are a lot of trainers whose egos will say, oh, I can fix that. Don't worry about it. And they're going to be punishment-based trainers because the reward-based trainer is most likely just going to recommend management and just having the dogs eat separately. And there's just no need to put those two dogs in that position. That is punishing in itself. So instead of saying, hey, let me get my ego in here and say, oh, yep, we can fix this. I can fix it too. Just put them in separate rooms or put a gate up between them with a towel over it. No big deal. Problem fixed.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I get it. I know this family. Obviously, they're my family. But I sit there and go, you're doing some, why are you yelling? It's so much more work to yell than to just separate the dogs. I agree with you on that. And it's, you know, and that's why you're the trainer and I'm not, because I don't know how to tell people to do that, to not, you know, because I'm just, you know, I think family is part of it. But, you know, where it's like, you're being lazy. Just like, why can't you just sit with the dog somewhere else? You know, even if the one dog finishes early, just take him somewhere else so that the dog can eat in peace, because, you know, in the end, you're going to make the dog, and I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong in this thought, but you're going to make the dog scared to eat. Like, the dog's always going to have, dog's always going to be nervous to eat, you know, and it's, and it might transfer to a person eventually. It might be that he gets scared that someone's going to come hit him, or someone's going to come take, you know, like, in, and he's going to redirect on a human or a kid, or if a kid's there and the kid doesn't know what they're doing and the kid is just walking up and you're not paying attention. And, you know, that's you, you're starting to create domino effect of something terrible happen when all you, like you said, all you have to do, just separate the dogs. You know, yes, it's an inconvenience for 5 minutes out of your day.
To but just is it really an inconvenience though? I mean, you set a bowl down in one room, you put a gate behind you, you take the dog into the other room. I mean, I have up to 5 dogs in my house pretty much at any given time. Guess what? Nobody eats together and it doesn't take me any longer. I can get 5 dogs let outside in the morning and fed breakfast in an enriching way in 45 minutes.
But I think that's the problem with a lot of people though, is that I'm not trying to defend them. I'm just saying, I think that's what the problem is though. Cause when you say it out loud, you're like, okay, that really isn't that big of a deal. But in the moment you're like, oh, you know, I mean, I have it too. You know, when I need
but
to feed my dog.
It's just changing your routine. And as soon as you do it for 5 days, your routine is done. And well, you, if you want your dog's behavior changed, you have to change your behavior. If want to not have another responsibility, get a stuffed animal.
I need you to have to come talk to my family and see if that works, because I've tried. I'm obviously not doing it right. You know, I totally get what you're saying. It's just, you know, I think there's just people where it's hard to go that change. But, you know, like we're talking now and I'm like, you're right. It is. It's that simple. Just do that. But like getting people to say it and then to do it, I think is different things. And like, and that's the tough part with why I could never be a trainer, because I don't have the patience to work with people to do that. And I don't want you to say if you do or don't. I'm assuming you do. We're gonna be positive.
Oh, I have the patience of a saint.
Yeah.
But you know, don't hire me if you don't want my advice.
Right. So let's move on to balance training, because this is another what I feel like is a buzzword in this industry. You know, people who, you know, don't want to say, oh, I use shock collars, but hey, I use reward based. So, you know, they're trying to appeal to a lot of different people. And, you know, there's different types of balance trainers. So they're not all the same, just like there's not all the same type of trainers, but balance trainers are definitely not all the same, because you have some balance trainers that are predominantly reward based, but if they can't get the behavior they want, they might move to something more punishment based. But then there's some balance trainers who will use reward based really shortly, like, oh, maybe just for sits. But then when they want to get more complicated, at least I think I'm saying it right, if they want to go, you know, they're quicker to go to the aversive side than they are the reward based side, but they don't necessarily only use, you know, the aversive stuff. And maybe you don't know, but how did balance, you know, I'm always kind of curious how balance training came about. Was it a new marketing term to try, hey, I don't want to show that I'm use shock collars right away, but I do reward-based stuff? Because if you're a balance trainer, can you be a certified trainer?
Okay, so balance trainers, I'm not really sure why they're called balance, because usually they're tipping to one side or the other, like you already mentioned. Generally, you're either reward-based and you may employ other tools. And generally those other tools are not aversive right away.
Okay.
And then there are more aversive that may employ treats sometimes. Like I said, I don't really understand why we have the need for aversives in most cases.
Right.
So with balance trainers, I think that it's, like I said, not so balanced. So I think we have a lot of trainers and training companies that basically just put a prong collar on right away and start using punishment right away without trying to use treats. Technically, following Lima protocol, anyone could be considered balanced.
Okay.
So I was once told by a very experienced trainer who was told by one of the world's greatest, and I'm not, because it's not my story, I'm not going to say who either of these trainers are,
right,
that this excellent, wonderful, well-known trainer, behavior professional of all animals, says that they have the skill and the knowledge to use a prone collar or an electric collar. And it is in their toolbox, not technically, like they don't own them and have them for dogs, but it is in their repertoire to be able to use it. But they've never had the need to because they are skilled enough to use positive reinforcement. So, you know, that being said, Lima Protocol literally wants you to use the least intrusive, minimally aversive methods first.
Right.
And if you try all of those things in an order and you start with reward-based and you can't figure out reward-based, and then maybe you use something less aversive like a squirt bottle to correct a behavior, and then you move up to something, you know, a little bit stronger and a little bit stronger, that is what Lima Protocol is. So if you're following that, and if you are skilled enough on the positive side and you can find those motivators and you know what makes behavior tick, then you shouldn't need to use the more aversive end.
Right. I see that a lot in some of the groups I'm in because training is one of those hot topic buttons where you have people on either side of the spectrum who all have opinions on what's best and what's not. And that's usually it's not a meme, but a graphic somebody has that puts up there that says, if you have good timing,
That's one of my favorite ones. Good timing.
I forgot what the other stuff is, but,
But it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, but then why do you need to use a shock collar then? Because you can do it with tree training, which is, it's true. But it's amazing to see people defending one side or the other. It's kind of what they use for that.
Well, and what I always find super interesting about punishment trainers is they're always talking about how it's not a one-size-fits-all program. Training isn't a one-size-fits-all program, but I find that our balance trainers lead more with it being one-size-fits-all because they slap a prong collar or an e-collar on, especially the companies that, you know, want dogs to look good and look good quickly. Because again, you know, that's a marketing strategy. Yeah. And, you know, a good trainer understands the four quadrants: negative punishment, negative reinforcement, positive punishment, positive reinforcement. They understand the four quadrants. They understand how to use them and when they should and should not be employed.
Right.
And that, again, kind of goes back to Lima Protocol. If you understand the four quadrants and you understand that reinforcement drives behavior and learning theory is the same throughout all animals, you know, kind of what we talked about with Amber, you're not going to put a prong collar on a hippo. You're just not going to do it.
Right.
So learning theory works the same for everybody. With people, you're not going to go to work if you're not getting paid. That is reinforcement. Your reinforcement and how much you get paid potentially for that job you're doing drives your behavior and drives your performance. Same thing with animals.
So I think you bring up a good point with the one size fits all. You're right. I see the balance trainers, some of these dog daycares that have trainers that say they have balance trainers on there who can't say they actually have a certified trainer on staff. They do all say that, hey, you know, we're a balance trainer because, you know, not one size fits all, you know, for our dogs. But a lot of those places immediately go to pinch collars, shock collars, whatever. Whereas most of the positive reward-based trainers, you're right, they do treats. That's the reward. But how they do treats and how they get to that point is different. Every reward-based trainer I've seen develops a plan for the dog based on what the dog needs. Yes, the only commonality is that you're giving treats. But like you said with your dogs, you know, liverwurst, I think it was, you know, the most grossest thing ever, you know, is what your dog likes, you know? So yes, it's a treat base, but you're figuring out what is highly motivating for your dog. As compared to some of these other balance trainers, aversive trainers who, hey, you know, the treat from PetSmart isn't working, so I'm just going to slap something else on there and get it done right now because, you know, I don't know if I want to say, I'm just going to say it. I feel like they're more focused on the money part of things than a lot of reward-based trainers. Because reward-based trainers know it takes time. Dogs are all different, just like people. Just like people, dogs all learn at different paces. Some dogs are not as smart as other dogs. Some dogs are totally smart and they can do it really fast.
Don't say smart, say motivated.
Okay, motivated. I'll say motivated.
I just prefer motivated because, yes, while some dogs are more proficient than others at certain things.
Right.
That doesn't mean that we just haven't figured out how to awake the behavior or the spirit or the motivation yeah. or whatever.
That's a good way to say
like
it.
With Hunk, I was like, he's dumb.
Yeah.
He is so dumb. I am not going to get anywhere with this dog. And then I figured out that a lot of it was anxiety and right. that's why his brain would reset. And then I figured out that I wasn't reinforcing him the way he wanted to be reinforced. So that was another huge part of it.
Wow. That's a good point. All right. Motivated. I'm going to use that now yeah, from now on.
Motivated.
I'm not going to say dumb. I'm not going to say any of that or smart, just motivation.
I'm not saying there aren't smart dogs, super smart dogs and super dumb dogs. But again, I find that once a dog learns the training game, your perception of their smartness changes.
Right.
Intelligence. That sounds better.
Right. Which I think is proving our point about positive trainers in that, you know, I've never heard a bounce trainer or any other trainer who isn't reward-based say what you just said, or at least a version of what you said. You know, you're not focused on getting it done fast. You're focused on getting it done right.
Well, you know? And like we talked about with your family, behavior change takes time, even for right. humans.
Right.
Think about things you've wanted to change. How many diets have you failed on because you're trying to change your behavior? How many, you know, exercise workout routines have you failed on because you're trying to change your behavior? So think about that for a dog. And they're not trying to change their behavior. You're trying to change their behavior. So if you're doing it wrong, or if you're doing it ineffectively, or you're doing it too quickly, it's going to fail.
Right. And I think that's another point is that what we want dogs to do to integrate into our lifestyle isn't necessarily natural for the dog. Like dogs don't sit to go outside. Dogs don't just sit to get food or to get, you know, that's not natural. You know,
they don't do the sit to say please unless they're taught. Sit
right,
means say
right,
please.
Right. You know, they don't, you know, I don't want to stay here. I want to go roam. You know, dogs are scavengers. Dogs, well, deep down, I don't know how much they are. I still think they kind of are. Mine are. Mine are totally counter surfers and, you know, and they're very, and my one dog is very sly and he's like, he'll wait. And he knows as soon as you're not paying attention, jumps up, goes down and it's like a shark or, you know, somebody just attacking something. Like he is so sly about it. And like, it's hard, you know, it's hard to catch him sometimes unless, you know, he's like, you know, you can see him like antsing up and waiting and, you know, trying to go for it. But sometimes he's just quick. He's such an opportunist for food on the table, on the counter. Like,
well,
he's
dogs
just like,
are labeled as opportunistic scavengers.
Right.
I mean, if you're going to also think about the fact that we are not only changing behavior, we are working against genetics sometimes. We are, you know, working against, you know, things that are ingrained in them that you know, they are built to do or... Okay,
right.
Dude.
as your dog is now, is, I know people can't see it, but you know, he's crawling all over the couch where Allie is sitting and trying to get in the way.
He is rebounding off my back right now, trying to look out the window.
Nice. But yeah, you know, and no matter, I mean, we think of dogs as being domesticated, but they still have genes that are still ingrained in them about whatever breed they are. They still have things that is still.
They're still animals.
Right. So keeping on the topic of genetics, some of the trainers who are balanced or aversive, they say that certain breeds have certain needs, meaning, when I usually see people talking about that, usually means that's why I use a shock collar. That's why I use a pinch collar. And I've heard it from even people who are very animal savvy who are like, well, you know what, pit bulls, you know, they need to have a pinch collar because they, you know, because they don't feel they just need to, you know, I need to control them more. I need to, you know, that because they don't feel a normal collar. They don't, you know, and there's times where my pit bull terrier where she's only like 50 pounds, but she is pure muscle and you put a harness on her. And when she really wants to go, she'll pull. I mean, she doesn't pull me down. I'm 240 pounds, but she is strong where she is. I mean, if I really just like, let her pull me without fighting back. She could pull me down the street if she really wanted to, when she gets that motivated to go after whatever is out there. You know, she is super strong, but I would never put a pinch collar on her from what I know and studied and even talking with you even more reinforces what I won't do. You know, like, but I don't think it's necessarily, her breed is strong, but I don't think you need to put, you know, a pinch collar on her to control her. she does really well with food. She's very, you know, she's very motivated that way.
Yeah. Well, and when we say different breeds have different needs, that's not necessarily just a, you know, punishment training base. I absolutely agree as a positive reinforcement trainer, different breeds have different needs, but it's not necessarily that different breeds have different needs. Different dogs have different needs.
Right.
However, that does not mean that I need a heavier hand for a certain breed of dog. I have three pitties and none of them need to wear prong collars. One of them doesn't even wear a harness because she's non-reactive and she's not going to damage her trachea by pulling, and she's not going to try to pull me down for anything. We use harnesses as a tool to train, but it doesn't cause damage to the trachea. It doesn't cause punctures in the skin. It doesn't cause burn marks in the skin. It doesn't cause dogs to become aggressive. Now, I work with a lot of power breeds, Dobermans, Pitbulls, Rottweilers, German Shepherds. I haven't had a male yet, but I plan on having one of my own at some point in my life.
Right.
But these power breeds don't need a heavier hand. These dogs are actually probably the ones that really, really, really shouldn't have that because of the risk of behavior fallout. We are literally creating a ticking time bomb in a huge 110-pound German Shepherd when we use a prong collar on them. It goes back to using their genetics in the right way. So if I'm working with a hound and, you know, sniffing out a scent is reinforcing, if I get them to do a behavior and then I release them to go sniff as a motivator, that works.
Right.
That plays with their genetics.
Right.
If I have, like with Hunk, he likes to run. So the tennis ball takes care of that. That is the running part, and the chasing part is what's reinforcing to him. So it's not that I need to use a heavier hand. It's that I need to reevaluate my strategies of motivation for that dog based on their personal specific needs. I mean, I have three pitties and they're all different. Every single one of them is different. Every single one of their motivators is different. And, you know, they're all the same breed. They're all the same.
Right. They're just, they all have their own personalities and they do what they got to do. You know, as we talked with Amber, I think I asked her, or in some way asked this question of, you know, because in zoos, it used to be a heavy hand is what people did. You know, they beat animals to do what they wanted. I mean, we've seen all the circuses and what they do to elephants, tigers and bears and oh my, all that stuff. And I, part of that, I think, is human nature of needing to dominate. And, you know, if we can't get something, we have to be angry and we have to use force to get, you know, to get, that's human psychology. I'm not going to go into that because I'm not that kind of, I don't know enough about that, but.
Well, and touching on that, punishment is reinforcing for the user.
Good point.
Because we're getting those results that we're seeking
right.
quickly. So right. it is reinforcing to us. So going back to reinforcement, again, if you're reinforced by getting results, which who isn't?
Right.
But also at the same hand, what's reinforcing about causing pain to any of your loved ones or someone else's loved ones?
Yeah, you're right. You know, if you sit down and think about it, what is reinforcing about hurting or causing pain to something else? But it is. Like, you know,
well,
like,
they don't necessarily think about it like that. I mean, unless right. you're a sociopath, but,
right.
you know, they think about it like, hey, I just got results. Well, guess what? I can get results with treats and feel 10 times better about how I did it and who I am as a human being and how I treat animals.
Right. And I think, you know, I think some of it might just be frustration of not knowing how to control the situation. Like, you know, okay, we yell at a dog, we do this because we, as the person doesn't know what to do. So we go to yelling, we go to, because as just like dogs learn, hey, barking works to get something away. We've learned that, hey, yelling gets what we want. That gets the situation to stop. That gets whatever, you know, we hit, that gets somebody to stop, you know, it is like you're talking. It's like, it's crazy how we're not that much different in the learning aspect of a dog compared, you know, how we would, you know, how dogs learn to how we learn. And it's just funny that, I don't know if it's funny, but it's just, it's interesting that we can't have empathy towards the dog to see it that way, that, hey, you don't need to do this kind of stuff, you know, cause it's just like us, you know, of course, we're going to, if humans are going to learn great, if somebody hit us all the time, we're going to learn really quick what to do or shut down and not do anything, which is,
but you're going to flinch a lot more when people raise their arm.
Right.
And that is the same thing that happens with our animals.
Right. So let's move on to positive reinforcement. And this is another big one. And I think we've talked a lot about positive reinforcement throughout this whole podcast. So, you know, we might not have too much to say here. So positive trainers or reward-based trainers get a lot of hate from all the other types of trainers that saying, oh, you're going to make the dog fat. You always do, you know, you have to give
bribing
treats.
Them.
Right. You're going to have to do treats for the rest of their lives, which is not true. Once the dog learns the behavior, you can start doing other stuff. It's a learned behavior. You just have to keep rewarding it, just like work. You don't get paid for 1 year of work and then never get paid for the rest of your life. You get paid every 2 weeks or a month or, you know, however your pay schedule works. That's the same thing with dogs. Just like there's like a balance trainer, there's a big wide range of different types of balance trainers on either side of the spectrum. Are there different types of positive or reward-based trainers? Are some not certified trainers? Because that's the only way you can become a certified trainer is if you are purely reward-based, right? Or am I wrong in that sense?
No, I mean, there are plenty of, I'm sure, certified trainers that choose to use punishment. Now they can be reported to their certifying organization if you're seeing them doing things that go against their school statement. Okay. I'm not super familiar with all of the statements. I know for Care and Prior Academy, we have to sign a yearly pledge, you know, says we will uphold the standards that they have put forth for us. And if you choose not to renew and you choose not to sign that pledge and uphold that pledge, you know, they will remove you from the organization.
And that's not to say that if you went to PetSmart, and I know PetSmart has a whole program now that's all about positive reward-based training. And so nothing is saying that, you know, just because those trainers may not be certified doesn't mean that they're bad. What it really comes down to, and maybe what you should look for, well, I don't know how you look for this, but is having a trainer that's good in timing. Because that's really what we talk about with everything we do, is having good timing. You know, because even, you know, if you don't have good timing with the shock collar is not going to do what you want. Your dog's just going to shut down.
Yeah.
But with treat training, you can do the same thing. You're just feeding your dog a lot of treats who's learning a behavior that isn't the right behavior.
Yeah. I mean, well, you brought up a good point. Are all positive reinforcement trainers certified? Even all positive reinforcement trainers are not created equal. No trainer is created equal, whether they are aversive, balanced, all rewards-based. No trainer is created equal. So that's why I brought up the point of continued education.
Right.
So continued education can be seminars. It can be workshops. It can be reading. It can be mentorships.
And I think what we should put in what to look for a trainer is that if anybody says they're a dog expert, you need to walk away, because nobody expert means that you cannot learn anything more, that you know everything for whatever you're talking about. So if we're talking about dogs, that person knows everything about a dog. And that is just not true. Things are changing. They change by the year. Things that people learn new things about dogs.
That's why our certifying organizations offer continued education units. So when I take a online course, I get a certain amount of what they're called CEUs.
Yeah.
And that I have to get a certain amount per year to keep my certification current. If I don't, I have to recertify. So
which is a big pain in the butt, right?
Science. Yeah. I don't really want to go through KPA again, as much as I enjoyed, you know, being a nervous wreck every couple weekends. No thanks. I loved my experience with KPA. Science is always changing. Science is always improving and coming up with new information. So, you know, I will never know everything. It doesn't matter. I've done 2 different seminars in the month of May, and, you know, they were long and they were lots of speakers and lots of topics, and I will still never know everything.
Right.
You know, I think what makes a good trainer is learning and gaining experience from other people. You know, learning, listening, reading. That's what makes, I think, you know, all trainers are not created equal. Some are in the mindset that they know enough and they don't need to learn anymore. And they don't get CEUs and they don't attend seminars. And there are some that attend what they have to get their CEUs to keep their certification. And then there are people like me and a lot of other trainers that I have in my personal network and professional network that just love to learn and take a lot of time to just read books. I mean, I have, you know, a stack of books on my bookshelf that are the still need to read books. And someday I will get time for them. And I have recordings from the conferences that I just did that, yep, someday I will certainly get to watch all of them. And, you know, my aggression seminar that I did, that I completed a couple of months ago, there's live mentorships once a week that some days I make it to, and some days I need to where I'll watch the recordings. But, you know, I think that that's what not necessarily even just those classes sets me apart from even positive reinforcement trainers that think that they do enough and that they've learned enough. You know, we are humans. There's always things to learn. You are never going to know everything. And the day that you think that you do, guess what? Science is going to change and throw you a curveball and completely introduce something new. So good luck with that. Yeah, I mean, if I were out there hiring a trainer for one of my dogs, which that's not to say that I would never send my dog to another trainer or use another trainer. Actually, I'm hoping to work with another trainer on nail trims because I'm just kind of stuck where I'm at. And she is an amazing, amazing, amazing expert at cooperative husbandry, Laura Monaco Torelli. So I'm hoping that we get to work with her because, again, you know, I'd love to learn if she's got some advice. And, you know, while I can do it for a lot of dogs, I just can't get Hunk to let me touch his feet. So right. I need help.
Right. So I guess something we didn't talk about with the balanced or aversive is, I don't know if it's an elephant in the room type thing, but, and I don't think it is because some of those trainers are very open about it that, hey, you need to dominate your dog, which we know is an outdated theory, but it's still out there. It's still prevalent. It's still, you go to these places that do the board and trains that, you know, 2 weeks and it's guaranteed. It's all about dominance. You know, you need to show your dog who's boss. You need to, you know, all that kind of stuff where you don't need to do that. So why is that an outdated viewpoint?
So short-term version of dominance theory, our dogs know that we are not dogs. Our dogs know that we are humans. Prong collars do not reflect mom's teeth on baby's necks. Alpha rolls do not reflect a dog pinning them down. None of the things that we do to our dogs do our dogs perceive as a dog-dog relationship.
Right.
They see it as
whatever a dog it is. Yeah.
Breaking the bond. And, you know, our dog's not going to look at us as, oh, you're trying to dominate me. And that's why you alpha rolled me. They're going to be like, what the hell did I do? And why did that just happen? Why did you just flip me on my back? And then again, we can experience some of that behavior fallout.
Yeah. I mean, and I think once you learn how to read dog body language, when you watch videos of people doing that, you see exactly what you said, where it is just like the dog just has that shocked look on their face, like WTF, like, yeah. You know, like what's going on? Like they did, like, you can tell they don't understand what's going on. And I think it works also with when you see the videos of trainers who use shock collars, who, you know, who are like, look at how well-trained my dog is. There was this one that somebody was touting that the dog would sit, in the video, they were in the woods and that trainer was having, or I loosely call him a trainer, was having the dog go from, it started in one direction, went 180, then went back, then went 80, and just kept going back and forth. And it was touting how great of a trainer it is. And look, the dog's doing it. The dog's having a lot of fun. But if you really looked at the body language of the dog's tongue was hanging out. The dog looked so, didn't look scared, and that's not the right word for it, but he was so intense. I'm trying to think of the right word to say what it was, but he was so hyped up. The dog was so like, just like, oh, go, you know, go back for it. Go, 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 go. Like the dog wasn't even like, I don't even think the dog was having fun because he was so focused on whatever. You know, it's like what I see with police dogs, you know, when everyone's like, oh, police dogs are so well-trained. And I'm like, well, if they were so well trained, then why don't they release when they bite the suspect? Why do I see countless videos of the handlers having to like trying to rip the dog off the person's arm, leg, whatever the dog is biting? I've seen it in action where, you know, the dog just doesn't want to let go. And it was on somebody who was wearing a bodysuit, so no one got hurt. But like, that's intense. Until that point, I've never seen a dog that focused and that, I don't know what the term is where the dog, not blacks out, but totally ignores you. Like, you know, they're not hearing they are so intense in what they're doing that they're not even listening to you. Just like, I guess, like if a dog's going after a squirrel, sometimes they just get so focused on that they don't even hear you calling their name. Like they're already past that point of and I don't know what that's
over
called.
Threshold.
Over threshold. For. Thank you. I couldn't think of that word. I was trying to figure it out. Well,
so police dogs are generally trained with aversives.
Right.
And
you have to get them intense.
It's agitation work. We are literally causing them pain when they see the bad guy, and that is what causes them to want to attack that bad guy and have an aggressive response to that bad guy. So thinking about, you know, if we're using a prong collar for a reactive dog and they see another dog and they get a yank, that is agitation work. That is what we do to train a police dog to attack bad guy.
Right.
We agitate them.
Well, and the bite is such a release, just, you know, is such a, oh, I finally get to bite the person, you know, the, whatever it is, you know, it's such a release that they, you know, I can't think of a better word to say than black out, but you know, they're not listening because it's such a reward to bite that they don't want to let go because they finally get to do it because they've been trained.
That frustration out. I mean, they don't just get to run out and go get them, you know, we're holding them and agitating them as we're doing it.
It's scary, you know, to know how they're trained. And, you know, I've gotten into some arguments with trainers who are like, I train police dogs. It's not that bad. I'm like, but from what I've learned, how can you train a dog? Cause I don't know if it's true that dogs don't naturally want to bite. Like that's usually a last resort to want to bite. Yes. There are some dogs that are more aggressive than others. Just like there's people who are more aggressive than others. There's people who have short tempers. There's people who can take a while to get the temper, you know, to get a temper, you know, they're just like people, dogs are the same way. There's, you know, and people breed dogs to get some of those characteristics. Is that the right word for it? Yeah. You know, to get there. But in the end, dogs don't naturally go for the bite right away. Right? Or am I wrong in that? I mean, obviously, there's always exceptions where there's some dogs who do
it. Yes, generally, dogs bite out of. Yes, I've given you all the other warnings, and I've given you all the chances, and now I'm going to bite because I feel like I have no other options.
Right. You know, police training is totally different, or any you know, protection.
Well, and there are perfectly well trained bite protection sport dogs that use only positive reinforcement.
Okay.
There is a shift happening in the canine unit industry that they are starting to use positive reinforcement in training their canines.
Right. And I did when I learned how to be a pet tech instructor for pet first aid and CPR, one of my other classmates was a reward-based trainer who does work with police dogs. And I was very fascinated because I've never met someone like that who was reward-based, who worked with police dogs. Because from what I learned, I'm like, how does that work? I was like, my mind was like imploded. I'm like, how does that work from how I understand you get a dog to be like that? You know, and he went in and he said, it's hard. Like, it's very hard. He's probably more on the balance side because eventually you have to go. You know, I think he was saying eventually kind of have to go to the aversive side to make the dog do what they do, you know, to a point. You know, like I said, I don't know everything about how they're trained. I just know some things about it. But so it was interesting to talk to him about how they do things with it. But it's interesting that you're saying there's more of a shift going to reward based. And I, you know, that's kind of makes me curious and want to research it now because I'm kind of curious how you teach a dog to be that aggressive, which I think is the right word, you know, for it, how you teach it with, I guess you could teach anything with reward based to be.
Well, I don't know enough about it, but I know enough about animal theory to kind of explain it this way. So picking the dog for the task, if you pick a dog that is reinforced by that drive to go chase something down and grab it, like Malinois, German Shepherds, you know, Dobermans, they're all very good at protection sports, even trained in a positive way. So if you build that drive to want to go chase something down and take it down, you know, it's just, you know, it could be a motivating factor in itself to go over there and bite and hold, but it's something that can easily be taught as well. Kind of like with scent work with Hunk that I've been working on. He doesn't have a natural drive to go smell clove. I had to create that by reinforcing it with his highest motivator, the ball. So again, picking the dog for the task, obviously for scent work and stuff like that, if you have a dog that's, you know, really, really happy about going and sniffing things and they find that reinforcing, or even just working dogs finding any work for them, you know, and they find that reinforcing, picking the dog for the task as well as building a drive for it. You can build a drive for anything. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be so driven that they're going to be great at whatever sport we've picked for them. But also, like Chunk, she's never going to be an agility dog. It doesn't matter how much drive I build in her. She's just not going to be an agility dog. And that's okay. I'm not going to pick her to be my prized agility dog. I'm not going to pick anybody to be my prized agility dog. But, you know, then there's Hunk, who's, I like to work, I will do anything. But if I put him in like fly ball or something that, you know, he knows creates a tennis ball, I mean, that's why he has such a great recall. I can call him off of anything because A-B-A-L-L, and I'm spelling it because he keeps perking up at me. You know, that is his number one motivator. If that is produced, he will do anything for it. And he will do it happily. And he will, you know, so if I wanted to teach that him biting onto a bite sleeve produced a round green thing, then guess what? He would probably be motivated to do so.
Right. I think we've talked a lot about the training, and I don't think we're not even close to being done about talking about everything with it. I know we'll have more podcasts where we'll probably again talk about training and techniques if we learn something new. But I do know, for me at least, you know, I know some things, and just like you, I don't know everything, and I definitely don't know as much as you do. But every time I talk to you, even whether it's in this podcast or, you know, outside in real life, you know, you always make me see the importance of trainers. Like, you know, sometimes you make things like seem so easy. And I'm like, that's just, you know, like we were arguing about my family, you know, we're just like, oh, just move them. And I'm like, you make it sound so easy. It's just not that easy when you have, when you have people in there. But I think that brings up why trainers are important, because, you know, whether it's doing something simple, and I know you do like day training stuff where you're like, why would people do day training? Like, cause they don't have time. You know, people are so busy. I mean, with COVID-19, some people are home more than others, but it's still, it's having that motive, like you said, motivation to do it. You know, yes.
Well, it does take a certain amount of skill. Like, yes, I can hand off, you know, here, work with your reactive dog on this. But there are so many people that are like, can I just send them to you for day training? It's not because we don't want to put in the work, because I tell clients, you know, you're going to have to put in the work. I can't fix your reactive dog in 5 sessions or 10 sessions. Like, that is a lifelong management and training situation. Yes, we can absolutely get them to the point where they'll hardly react, but guess what? It's still in them. So if we aren't managing the situation, or we aren't prepared for the situation, then we're setting everybody up to fail. So, you know, it takes skill. Training takes skill. So that is why, you know, I offer the service that I do, not because I want my puppy owners or my adult dog owners to be lazy and not put in the work, because I set them up and say, listen, you're going to have to put in the work. You know, foundation behaviors, yes, I can teach the sit, I can teach the down, I can teach, you know, the stay, the come, all those things that can easily transfer over. However, if I teach it to you and then all of a sudden you don't get reinforced for 2 years because your owner or your parent isn't keeping up on it,
right?
It's going to go away. So, you know, I let owners know, this is not going to fix your dog. This is not going to make your dog perfect for the rest of its life. Your dog is a lifelong commitment, not just financially, not just medically, not just, you know, because they have to live under your roof, but training as well. Your dog's going to change. Your dog is going to develop new behavior sensitivities. It's not, you know, your dog is a lifelong commitment in every sense of that topic. And yes, I do offer services that mostly are not offered because there is no guarantee, like the day training and the board and train. However, I set my owners up for success by letting them know that you're going to have work to do when you get home. Yes, the programs can be effective for some things, but the programs are not effective for all things. I don't guarantee behavior. I don't guarantee a fix. I don't guarantee a cure. I don't believe that dogs can be fixed or cured. I think that those behaviors are still there,
right,
but we do enough of a good enough job of managing and training and behavior modification to hopefully not see those behaviors often or ever again.
Right. And I think that's what, I think what you offer that a lot of trainers don't offer is that, and like you said, you get that started. I think that's where a lot of people have trouble, is just getting started with training. You know, they have a dog that pulls, they have a dog, you know, I'm have one of those dogs that, you know, we've worked on blocking the windows out, but you know, he still can hear a dog down the street and is like, rawr, rawr, you know, like barking away, you know, and we're working on it, but it takes time. But, you know, I think that's what's great about what you do and some other trainers do, is you just get it started for people, where, you know, I think that's just the biggest, that's the toughest part for a lot of people, is how do you start training a dog, where if you can get it started, you know, it's easier to maintain it than it is to do all the work to get the dog to that point. You know, and I think that's what's kind of cool about what you do with the day training. And I'm starting to see it more in a lot of daycares and stuff like that around the country that are starting to offer that kind of stuff. It's still not like dominant or prominent in the world, but it's starting to get there, where people are realizing that, you know, who maybe have the same love that I do and the same goal of trying to keep dogs out of shelters, you know, trying to make sure that families have the best they can with their dogs and humans get to work well together, that's what they're offering now. You know, it's maybe not the, you know, the 2-week guarantee, but we're going to get it started. And then, you know, you have to maintain it. Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed learning about the different types of training methods and why we think reward-based training is the best. If you're enjoying what you're hearing and haven't yet, please subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on. And also, please share our podcast on social media. You can also join our Facebook group at Who's Training Who to chat about this topic or anything really about dogs. If you have a topic idea or an Ask a Trainer question, please comment in our Facebook group or email info@waggytails.pet. Thanks for listening to Who's Training Who.